You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A 14-year-old boy was killed and six people attending a wedding were wounded in Fallujah, Iraq today. A passing U.S. military patrol, thinking it was under attack, opened fire after wedding guests fired celebratory shots into the air. Well, as such friendly fire incidents continue to raise anger and resentment among ordinary Iraqis of life under U.S. occupation, we're going to spend the second half of our show today continuing our examination of the human cost of war. Every day this week, we've been playing excerpts of a documentary entitled Beyond War, which takes a look at the real effects of war, not just on soldiers who choose to fight, but on innocent civilians who often find themselves caught up in the circumstances of violence through forces beyond their own control. In today's segment, we ask, how do we fully exhaust peaceful options before resorting to military action? And is war ever necessary, or do no ends justify the large-scale killing of human beings?
I love the flag. I love the symbol of it. I love what it stands for. I get tears in my eyes when I see the flag raised and hear the national anthem. But right now we have a situation where people think it's patriotic to wrap yourself in the American flag and agree with everything the government says. You can't speak out right now. We're at war against terror. No, we're Americans. We can't turn off the brain.
Why anti-war Americans believe that protest is patriotic. You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For some in the United States, it's a question of values, of choices about what kind of a society they wish to live in. They ask whether military power must dominate so much of American life. Should the armed forces play such a strong role in America's relationship with the rest of the world? Should the nation devote so much of its financial resources to supporting the military? But others feel that to diminish the armed forces would be to weaken their country, to render it vulnerable in a frightening era to the real possibility of attack.
My mom was on the phone and she said, "I'm very concerned about this kamikaze attack." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "The airplane." And I said, "What?" And she said, the World Trade Center where your brother works.
David Petorti was at home with his family in Cary, North Carolina, when he learned that his older brother James, an employee at Marsh & McLennan in New York, had been killed on September 11, 2001.
The TV was on and I saw that image that everybody on Earth has seen of just the smoke coming out of the tower and just, you know, stood there dumbfounded. And I said, "What floor was he on?" And she said he was on the 95th floor. And I knew it was 110 stories, so I was counting down with my eyes, you know, where is that hole? And man, it was right where that hole was. And I just remember that sinking feeling in my stomach, just that nausea of, oh my God.
You've said that you became, of course, very, very sad, but never angry.
Mm-hmm.
Hard for many very angry Americans to believe.
When this happens to you, when you lose someone in your family, when you are directly affected by violence, the last thing in the world you want is for there to be more violence. So your reaction is, no more. So that was my reaction. No more violence, no more anger. I was angry at a world where this could happen. I was angry for whatever it was we've contributed to the world to make people hate us so much that they would want to attack us in this way. But I've had discussions with other people in my group, and just no anger, just sadness that there's this evil in the world, and how can I reduce it? How can I prevent there from being more death?
David Petorti is active in an organization called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. He was one of hundreds of thousands of faces in the crowd in New York City on February 15, 2003, the day an estimated 7 million people worldwide came onto the streets peacefully to demonstrate against the impending American-led invasion of Iraq. By all accounts, it was the largest global war protest in recorded history. In New York, young and old gathered on a bitter cold day. One woman held a sign that read, "Ground Zero Workers for Peace."
Were you a Ground Zero worker?
Yeah, 9/11 EMT.
And tell me why you're here today.
Well, we formed a group shortly after 9/11 because we didn't want our names to be used to propagate further violence. And our job as EMTs and public servants is to protect and to serve. When we come across an accident victim, we don't ask them what their religion is, where they came from before that we treat them, and we try to save them at all costs. So given that, it doesn't make sense for us to support the creation of more casualties.
I'm a retired educator, and I also am a delegate to the United Nations for Pax Christi International, which is a Catholic movement for peace. I don't think Jesus would bomb. I hate to be presumptuous, but I don't think he would bomb anyone. And he would encourage us to look for a decision that was based on human rights for everyone as a one family.
From the speaker's platform in Manhattan, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Nobel Peace Prize winner from South Africa, looked out on a throng of demonstrators that extended as far as the eye could see. His message was intended to be humanitarian and anti-war.
Those who are going to be killed are not collateral damage. They are human beings of flesh and blood. They are children. They are mothers. They are brothers. They are grandfathers. You know what? They are our sisters and brothers, for we belong in one family. We are members of one family, God's family, the human family. And how can we say we want to drop bombs on our sisters and brothers, on our children? We said no to communism. We said no to apartheid. We said no to injustice. We said no to oppression. And we said yes to freedom. Yes to democracy. Now, I ask you, what do we say to war? I can't hear you. What do you say to war? What do you say to death and destruction? What do you say to peace? I can't hear you. What do you say to peace?
The investment on the military since 1945 is roughly $11 trillion.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Bernard Laun, M.D., at his home in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Now, $11 trillion is an astronomic figure that evades our imagination. There's no way one can encompass it. But if you start asking yourself, what is its magnitude translatable to? Everything above surface in the United States, every house, every bus, every train, every plane, every museum, every school, everything could be bought for less than $11 trillion.
America's decades-long commitment to massive spending on the military has rendered the U.S. Armed Forces by far the best equipped and strongest in the world. And many Americans derive a great sense of security from the peerless power of their nation's military. David Patorti of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows.
Look, defense is necessary and practical. We have to have defense, but where was it on September 11th? That's the question I asked. If almost $1 billion a day for defense didn't save my brother on September 11th, why is giving them more money now going to solve any more problems? Why are we throwing good money after bad? I think these are messages to us that more money for the military is not the answer, and we've got to start seeking alternatives to just dropping more bombs.
Look, in the Middle East, you know how we get oil? By selling them weapons.
Dr. Bernard Laun.
The most weaponized part of the world is the Middle East. We were investing in the wrong thing. If we had invested a fraction of that, if we had developed alternative energy for the United States, which we easily can do, we have the technology not to rely on oil. Solar power, wind power, ocean power, saline power, you name it. Had we done that, there would not have been any terrorists. The terrorists are compelled by what we are doing in the Middle East.
In the United States, a telling measure of the nation's priorities is how the vast multi-trillion-dollar federal budget is carved up and parceled out each year in negotiations between Congress and the president. The sheer magnitude of the money available and the projects funded is mind-boggling. The National Priorities Project, headquartered in Northampton, Massachusetts, tracks the process in an attempt to provide what it calls data for democracy. The executive director is Greg Speeder.
We believe that national security is more than just weapons, that it has to do with having a decent, educated populace, a healthy populace. A single sub is $2 billion. That's a lot of money. I mean, when you compare it to some of the things that we could buy with that, that would provide health care for 200,000 children. So that's an enormous amount of money. The jet fighters that we want to build, the 300 and some billion dollars it will cost to provide more jet fighters, could rebuild every school that needs to be rebuilt in this country three times over. So, I mean, you can see that there's just some of these weapons are incredibly expensive. We spend as much on nuclear weapons as it would cost to provide health care for every child that doesn't have health care in this country. We're talking about 11 million children that don't have health care in this country.
You know, the United States comes from a position of having more weapons, including nuclear weapons, and more money than all these other countries all over the world.
In New York, Melissa Jameson of the War Resisters League.
So I think we're in a position to lead the way in terms of human rights and in terms of blazing a bold path for peace through peaceful means, as opposed to something that is so distinctively uncreative and unimaginative as bombing people, killing people you don't know, you know, harming other people's children. It is, on one hand, to me, why we need to go that other mile. You know, we have to try. Because I don't think we have any choice.
Do you think the current way has failed?
The current way of bombing all over the globe? Absolutely, yes. We're still having wars. We're still hurting people.
So, how does that make you feel?
Very, very sad. Very sad. Angry. It makes me want to work for change.
With the 1st Battalion, 7th Marines, they have spread out their focus somewhat. Now they want to branch out. They want to go after, actually search and destroy if they can, those paramilitary units or FETI.
News coverage of military action offers a numbing gallery of destruction. Cities burning, people firing weapons at each other, deafening explosions, the dead lying motionless. Television images of war can be startlingly compelling. The quest for alternatives to war to avert this misery rarely, if ever, earns the level of attention from our media that mass violence commands. That's because peaceful solutions seldom provide instant gratification, and because they require a change in people's hearts that is often invisible, so hard to capture through action photography. But the slow process of peace building, of breaking down the walls between people, is a way out of violent conflict. University of Florida religion professor Zohara Simmons.
Programs that reach out to people for exchanges, these kinds of things, which we of course do on a small scale, I think could be done on much larger scales, maybe high school students being exchanged in different countries to help people have a better sense of other people around the world that they maybe feel are very different from themselves. Monies for support of other nations, I think, could be used much more judiciously than it is in the propagation of peace and development. The fact that we have these glaring disparities between the so-called first world and third world nations, the suffering of people in many parts of the world that really could be benefited. I mean, everything from sharing technology with people, medicines with people, getting rid of all this international debt that people owe and are just struggling to pay. These are things that I think need to be really thought about, and I think that would lessen the kind of conflict we have in our world today.
For most of us, such concerns may be of interest, but are easily drowned out by the everyday chores and pastimes of life. Yet our relationship with the rest of the world has become urgently relevant in the wake of recent events. Physician and Nobel Peace Laureate Bernard Laun.
Where did those people who attacked the Twin Towers come from? We don't want to know. Why don't we want to know? Americans don't ask, why did it happen? No, it happened and we must respond. As a doctor, I'm looking for causes because I know I can only be effective as a healer if I identify the causes.
And what do you see as the causes of war in the world?
I see you will never have peace till you have a more equal playing fields economically. As you travel and see favelas where little children are bathing in dung, favelas, those little communities without hope, where thousands of people are crammed into crates.
Third world scenes.
Yeah, in Kampala, in Tebe, in Rio, in Sao Paulo, in any of the big cities, around them is a choking necklace of misery that reminds you of Dante's Inferno, of people living without electricity, without water, without education, without hope. And we will have terrorism come at us, come at us, come at us, till we waste our very soul of our being, Americans, who we are, what identifies us. The pride we take in our values have to be washed away because we haven't identified the cause. In the world today, 80% of all illness is due to lack of pure, clean water. 80% of all illness. What would it cost to clean up the water supply of the world? $300 billion. So 3% of what we have spent on war, we could create health. The point of it is, unless you face the truth, you suffer pain.
The daunting litany of global problems can lead people yearning for peace to the pitfall of fatalism. At times, it may seem that the whole world has become a terrifying place with no hope in sight. But pessimism can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, warns William Urey, a negotiation expert and author of The Third Side in Boulder, Colorado.
history is, you know, periods of peace divided by periods of war. And we tend to focus on the war because that's what grabs our attention. In fact, I mean, I think the reason why we see so much violence in the media is that, you know, they've got to get our attention, the TVs. They've got to get our attention to pay attention to the ads. What is the human brain wired to pay attention to? Obviously violence, because that's dangerous. And so we get fed violence and we get tales of violence, and that starts to create an image that there's nothing we can do about it. In fact, there's a lot that we can do about it. There's a lot that can be done to prevent violence. There are a lot of successful stories, and we need to learn to build on those stories. I mean, it's the greatest challenge that we face because, you know, the violence has been there. I mean, this last century has been perhaps the most violent century on human record, with over 100 million people dying in wars and over 175 million in political violence. And the challenge for this next century, if we're going to survive, is to learn better ways to deal with our differences through negotiation, through dialogue, through democracy, rather than through violence and warfare.
Peace will come, and let it begin with me. We need peace, and let it begin with me. Oh, my own life is all I can hope to control. Oh, let my life be lived for the good, good of my soul. Let it bring peace, sweet peace, and peace will come. Let it begin with me.
As important as all of the external, outward things that we do, and I certainly do those things, is that we have to work on ourselves. We have to internalize the peace that we want to see externally. We have to embody what it is that we want to see in the world. We want a peaceful world. We must be peaceful. We want a world that respects all life. Therefore, we must respect all life. These are the things that, if nurtured from the earliest times, would create a different kind of people. But we have just the opposite. And here in our country, the violence that we're constantly inundated with via the television, via our movies, the games that young people play, and now when you look at the programs on television, particularly the cable news, the glorification of war, so people are socialized into this. And it really pains my heart to see it, that instead of us being socialized to develop our loving qualities that God has imbued us with, we do just the opposite. I don't think it is something natural. I think it is very much a socialized thing that happens to us.
In recent years, movies highlighting military action and dramatizing the heroic sacrifice of soldiers have gained increasing prominence in our popular culture. From Saving Private Ryan to Black Hawk Down to We Were Soldiers, motion pictures help to shape our perceptions of war. It is a powerful trend in which the government takes more than a passing interest. Academy Award-winning cinematographer and director Haskell Wexler.
The government has a very aggressive, seductive policy toward helping scripts which foment militarism. It's very advantageous to a studio to have an action movie. Action movies translate to any kind of language, any kind of country. And what better action is there than a military movie? And if the script is approved by the Pentagon, then the filmmaker can have aircraft carriers, jet planes, tanks, Film like Pearl Harbor, for example, had, I think, it was 500 or 600 Marines donated, so to speak, to the film company to be as act as advisors and as special extras, so that it's just economically advantageous for a film company to make a war film. And of course, the kind of war film has to be approved by the Pentagon. They have advisors who just don't look at the script, but who are very knowledgeable and around the set to make sure that the ideas presented are worthy of the fact that billions of dollars of military equipment and taxpayer-supported troops and wherewithal is used to help them make the film.
Haskell Wexler casts a wary eye at this behind-the-scenes government influence on movie-making. He feels that a profusion of spectacular war films can give the public a distorted view of needed conflict resolution in our dangerous world.
There are alternative ways to solving human problems, because without those alternative ways being presented dramatically, the audience has a false dilemma. They say, here's a problem. Here's the only way we can solve it, by superior military force. And when you have that false dilemma, naturally people are going to say, well, I guess there's nothing else to try, nothing else to do.
A common belief is that warfare is simply inevitable, even innate in human beings. A belief some say that is sadly backed up by many bloody chapters of history. But others reject that view as a reading of history that overlooks long periods when people coexisted peacefully. They decry war as a deficiency of imagination, a tragic, barbaric failure to search adequately for nonviolent solutions to human conflict. And besides, says religion professor Zahara Simmons, what goes around comes around.
I do really believe that if I kill you, if I harm you, if I have hatred for you, another person, another group of people, that even though it might not be known to myself, I have done damage to myself, to my spiritual self, to my psychic and mental self. And that I open the door for retribution, for that to come back at me, possibly even physically. But it has damaged me at my deepest levels.
You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Kathy Graham. Music performed by Brad Hatfield. Research assistance by Erzalee Coquillon. Special thanks to WBEZ Chicago, WFCR Amherst, Rounder Records, and the University of Florida Public Affairs Department. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
Major funding for this program is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the Colomb Foundation, the Compton Foundation, and from this station and the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Beyond War is produced by David Freudberg and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. If you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of Beyond War by phone, please call toll-free 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. To learn more about this and other Humankind programs and to hear selected episodes online or to order tapes online, go to www.humanmedia.org. Tune in tomorrow on Peace Watch for the final part of this series. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at Pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.